Good evening, James McKenna here with My Science Hour. This is for January 5th, 2023, and the beginning of a brand new year. Last year, as you are probably aware if you've been listening to the show, I did a history, a complete commercial-free history, by the way. I would add a little bit of, you might call it advertisement, directing people to my webpage at the end of the show. But it was the history of my work, not my work, mind you, but the history, the anecdotes, the place I had been to, the reason I got to certain places in my life, etc., and putting it all into perspective. And so that's very important. I did that because I'm in the process of archiving my work, and to understand just the tone of the times, let's put it that way, would be very important. Imagine if you had that ability to go back to any scientist's life, and my work will shine through, and I will get credit for it at some point, but today the disinformation and the sheer dishonesty in science is just unbelievable. You know, calling nuclear power green because it doesn't emit CO2. It's one of the most horrific polluting power sources ever. And at some point, those casks are going to start to break open. And it's all about money and power. It's just an example, you know, the maintenance of what I call the axioms of astronomy. The idea that comets are dirty snowballs. And seeing the new crops of PhD physicists or astronomers, they're not physicists, they're mainly astronomers, coming up and, propounding this absolutely absurd, mantra. Just incredible to see, that this continues in the face of complete absurdity, and then the controlled opposition, where you have the YouTube, and we're starting to see what's coming out of Twitter and how that was manipulated and controlled by the FBI, the CIA, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. So anyway, now I'm going to get back to regular programming, and so there's a lot of things to catch up on, a lot of scientific topics. And also note that I just came out with a new book. This happened actually about a month ago. It's called The Real History of Man and Earth, Myth, Magic, and Mayhem. And the entire issue here was that there's a disinformation program that's just emerged, and it's been going on for a while, but it's starting to really get traction and public awareness. And so the issue is that people are claiming that a comet hit Earth 12,000 years ago and caused everything in the kitchen sink. Anything you can imagine gets thrown into this. And in any good disinformation program, you have controlled opposition and you have the White Hats. And the White Hats are a bunch of about 65 NASA-type university professors, etc., saying this. And then you have some independent journalists who are, I'm not going to name names, but are trying to make a point of this. And then just other independent, so-called independent researchers. And of course, none of them have any understanding or background in comets. And so, the idea that it's promoting the idea that comets are dirty snowballs, and that if they hit Earth, they're going to create nanodiamonds is one of the hypotheses, which is just absurd. And anything that's big enough to hit Earth and cause worldwide mass extinction would have to leave a pretty big mark, a big crater. And the debris field and everything else, especially if it was within the last 12,000 years, it would be noticeable. And the spray, etc. And additionally, there's nobody that's ever experimentally shown how something hitting Earth would cause nanodiamonds, or that the spray would then go up and then come down with enough velocity to penetrate bones, as you see in the mastodon. So the story just, it's just phony from beginning to end. It has no validity at all. And so the book that I had really was sitting on the shelf, ready to go, and I thought, you know, it's time for this book to be born, so to speak. So I completed the book, did the production work, and released it. But of course, whenever the CIA or the disinformation crew, as you can call them, gets a hold of a story, they have tremendous power of promotion. They get these people on major national radio shows, you know, and they go, oh, they're just swooning over themselves about how knowledgeable they are. And all this absolute disinformation comes out. Examples like, well, and things, a lot of information that's true, like the Egyptian pyramids were not built by the Egyptian pharaohs. I mean, the idea that that happened is just beyond absurd. With, you know, a bunch of people walking around in loincloths and pulling ropes and moving these, you know, megalithic blocks of granite that came from 500 miles away. You know, the idea, you know, that's just beyond absurd. And all of the amazing artwork, and not to mention the Peruvian blocks, the stonework, etc. I mean, they've made attempts at showing how some of this may have been done. But, you know, in today's world with billions of people on planet Earth and, you know, teams of engineers and architects and entire companies that build big things, nobody could move a single block of the pyramid. And then you find cities that are completely destroyed, completely blown apart, blown to pieces, literally, it looks like. And these were from what, a major electrical discharge hit during a passing comet. And so you find real information mixed in, and a lot of people out there questioning the so-called history of man. So this book was very timely. It was something that had to come out right now, and it's in the process of being released on a bigger basis, you know, radio shows coming up and going after this disinformation that's just raging out there. And there's, like I say, major radio shows like, say, Joe Rogan. And, you know, these people are well-meaning, but they're not knowledgeable about the history of misinformation, especially when it comes to science. You know, if you've listened to my show, you've followed my work, you know that the science that's presented is for to keep the public dumbed down, and this was intentional. What was it, like a 1954 document talking about dumbing down education for kids? You know, it's just horrific, to the effort to keep the public from really understanding what's really going on, and especially in outer space or with archaeology and the history of man. Thus my book, that is actually, it's a kind of a follow-on book to the prior book, which was called Planet X, Planet X Update, The Real History of Planet X, in which I go into the long detail of how the CIA took over NASA in 1991 and put the lid on them. And I saw it happening. I mean, I knew a lot of people personally in Goddard and JPL, especially, and also Los Alamos. In the 1980s, I was very familiar with these people, and all of a sudden, everything changed. It got really weird. Those people couldn't talk. They were under gag orders. A lot of them quit. A lot of the secretaries quit. I mean, it was just an overhaul, and the people that stayed, of course, they wanted their paycheck, could not talk. And so I would go to American Geophysical meetings, and they wouldn't even say hi to me. Because, of course, my work on comets became central to the whole deal of Hale-Bopp. And it turns out that Hale-Bopp, the comet Hale-Bopp, was literally the Planet X object that was discovered by Harrington. Literally was the Planet X object that everybody was looking for. And anyway, I'm not going to go into all that detail here, but my previous book was called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. And that's where I put together all of this, the disinformation program, and picked it apart and told you what was really going on and why. And so the current book is another real book, so to speak, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myth, Magic, and Mayhem. And myth, magic, and mayhem is what was passed down to us from the ancients. Myths, magic, and because they didn't know what was going on, and mayhem, literally mayhem, where these big comets would come by Earth, the Noah's Flood, the Moses-Venus event. And I make the point that the, you know, when the Mayans, for example, in the Popol Vuh talk about Venus, they're not talking about Venus the planet the way we see it today. They're talking about Venus the comet, the big comet. And that is a distinction that I make. And in the interpretation of that, and of course, that's what Velikovsky was doing. And of course, the other thing is that when they destroyed the name of Velikovsky, they created controlled opposition groups that still exist today. They're still out there today, roaming around, destroying the name of Velikovsky. And this was done in the early 2000s. There was a lot of CIA work done in the early 2000s, like 2004, a group was formed with a handler, none other than Tom Van Flandern. And so anyway, it's important to understand this history and misinformation, because I lived through it all. I was the person being attacked here. I was on the Old Art Bell Show talking about the Hale-Bopp issue and the fact that it had a companion. You know, these are all major issues because they were international, in-your-face issues going on. Okay, so another thing that's going on right now is I'm developing a new web page, and I believe I mentioned this, archiving all of my material, because there's so much there. If you look at the education package, like 181-hour lectures that really cover the major topics that you have to be aware of, and also many of those dealing with my books. So putting the books into perspective, etc. And if somebody went about actually studying my work, it would take them a very long time. And so I don't have to produce more material for the information that's available to the public. And I have more books coming out. I have a couple more prime number books that are on the shelf ready to come out. I have the additions to the Nazca Lines work that is coming out, etc. And so what I'm doing is organizing this material so it's available for posterity. And right now it's very available, but it's like I say, I'm kind of finalizing, organizing it into literally like an encyclopedia. And so that's yet coming out. So those are the kind of things I'm concentrating on. And I could fill this show week after week after week with disinformation that comes out. But I'm not going to, I might throw one or two things out there just to give you an idea of what's going on the planet. Like, for example, the race to go to Mars. NASA wants to go to Mars. Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. Everybody wants to go to Mars. And then in the background, you have Richard Branson, who had a third fatality accident on his program, just again as he's getting ready to actually be certified to send people into space. And apparently it was a pilot error, they're calling it. And three times during his history of developing the Virgin Space, it's called Virgin Galactic, branch of his many, many businesses, and putting, you know, literally probably billions of dollars into this out of his own pocket for space tourism. And of course, he was the first space tourism person to go, which meant he went in his own spacecraft. And that was, I think, last year in 2022. But they had a successful ride back to their, you know, the New Mexico airport, spaceport, where they are, where they have their situation housed there, where they all their equipment, etc., the carrier vehicle and all of that. But then just recently had a major accident. Let me list the three accidents that have happened to the Branson Project. And this, the first one was back in the Burt Rutan days when they were still out in the Mojave Desert at Burt Rutan's location. And they were testing an engine. They were testing a solid rocket fuel engine on a test bed, and it blew up and it killed one of the engineers. Maybe some more were injured. I remember there was at least one death. And that shut it down. Boom. And he was on his way. You know, he'd already won the X Prize. That went flawlessly, much to the chagrin, much to the amazement of military and NASA, etc., who had spent, of course, 50 years in untold billions of dollars, literally, you know, maybe up to $1 trillion trying to get people into space. And Burt Rutan comes along and does it for under $10 million, wins the Ansari X Prize, and just shocks everybody going into outer space two times in a row within the 7-day period with the same spacecraft. And the idea was that you had to take three people into space on these two successive missions within 7 days apart. And he did that, but they bent the rules and said, well, if there's an accident, there's no need to kill three people when it would only kill one. And so there was one actual person actually going into space, the pilot that was driving it. Maybe there were two, I don't remember. But the idea was that they had a bag of sand there taking the place of a human being. And they were successful, and they won the Ansari X Prize, and that started the whole X Prize thing, which is often, of course, I was part of a program there, the Water Abundance X Prize, and with the wing generator and the water from the air machines, etc. But anyway, back to Rutan. So that was the first accident in the Branson program, and that was right at the point where they were going to commercialize it. So that set them back for a period of time. Then there was the second accident, which was when they were just getting ready to commercialize once again and have paying customers getting online. And there was another fatal accident that one of the structures broke, and it crashed, and I think one guy was badly injured and another guy was killed, one of the pilots. And so that stopped it there. And they were just ready to commercialize. Now, just a month, within a month ago, I think, they had the new Spaceship Two carrier vehicle, the same one that Branson went up himself in, but they may have a number of them that are built to the same specification. But anyway, it crashes, and they call it a pilot error. And so the second one, it's like it could have been caused by an explosion of some kind, because it blew off one of the tail sections of the airplane, crashed in the desert and killed the pilot. So the one that just happened a month ago, they're calling it, they initially called it pilot error, but of course it has to be investigated by the FAA, who now has taken control of private space in the United States. And I always told these people, not directly, but indirectly, that they should not be putting their programs in the United States. They should go to some foreign country have some more privacy. But I always said that as soon as these private organizations, especially like Branson, who's doing it for space tourism, as soon as they get close to actually having it ready to go and putting, you know, live paying customers on board, it's going to have a little accident that isn't going to get there. And Branson himself said, okay, that's it. I think he's calling it quits on the space tourism part, although he does have satellite space launch capabilities there, where they have a airplane. It's like a jetliner that they take up and they can drop off a payload that then goes out into outer space, which is the real way to go into outer space. As you know, if you've seen my webpage, I have a hotel space launch system that I designed, and which will be someday the future of getting into space. Not this vertical rocket with, you know, like Musk's, this giant rocket that they built with 36 engines in it. Okay, that's wonderful, but you could save all that fuel by taking off from a runway. Anyway, but the point is that Branson's operation looks like it's been squelched to get people like you, paying customers, people on the street, to prevent people like you from getting into outer space. And that's a theme that I've been talking about for a long time. And, you know, and that's the whole point of NASA, Tier 2 science, garbage science, pound off to you, the public. Okay, so at any rate, you have to be wise to these things because most people are not. And, of course, the news media doesn't cover any of this, certainly not in a credible fashion. And the science news media does not cover it. It's all rah-rah, we're going into space, and it's all about making money. It's not about going into space, buddy. It's about companies making money attempting to go into space. Okay, so I'm going to jump onto a new topic here. Now, because of my show last year, I did not cover current events, so there's a few things I got to pick up the pieces here. One of them is a comet called K2. It's a C2017 K2 Pan-STAR is the official name of the comet. And that's the designation C for comet, 2017 for the year it was officially discovered. And they went back into the records to look, now that they knew what the orbit of this comet was when it was discovered, was around the orbit of Saturn. And that, of course, is a little bit of a misnomer because it was way out of the plane of the planets, way out of the ecliptic when it was discovered. So the distance from the sun was about the equivalent of the orbital distance of Saturn. But like I say, out of the plane of the planets. And then, because they knew the orbit, they said, okay, well, let's go back into some other photo plates that are being taken all the time of the sky. And they were able to go back as far as 2013 and see this comet. And so they go, oh, because nobody noticed it, of course, on these plates with millions of stars out there. I mean, nobody just really noticed this little fuzzy ball out there. But that created a big problem, because the comets are only supposed to be working within about the orbit of Jupiter. Hale-Bopp was discovered way out there also. And so then they said, wow, this must be a big comet. But the question is, how can a comet be activated by the sun, the sun's heat, at that kind of distance from the sun? And of course, it just can't. I mean, you look back at the sun at that distance, and the sun would look like pretty much another star, just kind of like a bigger than average star, not a whole lot of light. As I always say, it would be like an old-fashioned incandescent bulb flashlight in a London fog at 100 yards. Not a whole lot of power getting out there to sublimate the ices off this comet and cause it to be a comet, according to the Dirty Snowball Ice Ball comet model. And, of course, what I explain is that there should be a rich abundance of comets out in those regions, and it's because they're discharging the solar capacitor. In fact, one of my predictions was there should be abundance of comets in the nebular ion cloud, which is this dust and gas cloud that's held back by the solar wind pressure. And I showed those in my very early work. Oddly enough, just a caveat here, people are seeing comets now in other solar systems. These are called exocomets, and they're exactly what I predicted, that these comets would be forming out in that very rich material nebular ion cloud by discharging the solar capacitor. which extends out into that region. In fact, that is the positive end in a giant plasma ball that surrounds the stars. And you see these around all the stars. All of the stars have these, all of the active stars, like our own sun, will have these. But at any rate, so K2 comet, they go back to the plates of 2013 and find this comet way, way, way out there. And of course, comets move very slow. But imagine all the other comets that are out there and not noticed because they're on these photographic plates of just star charts that they're to these very expensive big professional telescopes are out there snapping pictures of the entire sky. And imagine all the comets that are on those plates and nobody's ever noticed them before until one of them comes into the solar system and then is visible. Okay, so anyway, Comet K2 update here, and this is some very interesting stuff. Now, a listener wrote in and kind of roasted me. He said that when the comet crossed the ecliptic, there was a big solar flare. So this is back in later August. And I was in the middle of my year-long discussion of the history of my work, and so I did not want to interrupt that. And I didn't think in terms, I mean, even though this is what might be considered an important comet, it wasn't something that I wanted to interrupt that year-long dialogue to introduce in my show. So I'll pick up the pieces now. And what happened is that there happened to be a solar flare, a pretty good-sized one, on the far side of the sun. The only problem is that when this comet crossed the ecliptic plane on about the 28th of August is when this happened, and it did have a pretty good alignment with Mercury, Earth was not on the far side of the sun. Earth was about 60 degrees away from the line of sight of this comet and the sun. So anyway, but little Mercury was there, and Mercury is a spark plug, and it comes around very quickly, and it gives you that jolt, like a spark plug. Mercury, I would call the spark plug planet, interacted apparently with this comet. And we see many, many comets that went through brightening during an alignment with Mercury. And I went through one of my shows, I actually talked about this phenomenon where Mercury, and the reason this came up, by the way, is because there was a comet that was seen and had a great brightening. It was right between Earth and the sun. And so that's one electrical alignment there. And so the astronomers went back in history and they pulled up all the documents of these comets. Now, the reason this is unusual is because we're looking right through the comet at the sun. And it really, in a normal comet, there should really be nothing really visible. Because the tail is so diffuse. But all of a sudden, these comets had tremendous brightening when the comet was between us and Earth. And so then they developed this kind of theoretical work talking about this phenomenon. And so what I did is I went back and I said, okay, we got the dates. And that was a lot of times where these comets were crossing the ecliptic plane, so they were coming up from below or coming down from above and crossing the ecliptic plane. And I said, where was Mercury on these exact dates? And lo and behold, every time one of these comets exploded into brightness when it was between us and the sun, little Mercury was bingo right there. And so this comet K2, also, if you look on its orbital path, on August 28th of 2022, there's little Mercury. But it would be interesting to see not only that there was a solar flare, a sizable one, which really didn't have any reason for exploding, but to see the comet activity, and that would be another indicator that on the 28th of August, that this comet would have basically brightened considerably. So that's an outstanding question. And, of course, I don't have the data on the comet with me, but I'm sure there were a lot of telescopes worldwide, including amateurs, who were taking photographs, and it would be interesting if anybody out there knows of anybody who is taking pictures of this comet K2, look for that date, approximately the 28th of August, 2022, and see if the comet underwent brightening of any kind on that date or thereabouts. It could have been a little before, a little bit after, but certainly within a few days, 4 or 5 days before, 4 or 5 days afterwards. But pretty much on that date is the 28th. That's when Mercury was there. So that would have been the date to really look for that brightening. Okay, so that's the inbound side of comet K2. The outbound side is equally, if not more, interesting. So I followed this comet on its path. Now, right now, it's to give you an idea where it is. It's way down below the solar system. It's out of the ecliptic plane, and it's traveling up, and it has kind of a long sweep as it comes up out of the lower part of the solar system, and it crosses the ecliptic going out on the date of April 24th, 2025. So we're 2 years and, 3 months or 4 months about out in this where it's going to come up and cross the ecliptic. So I took a look at this, and sure enough, as it's coming up, now it's too far away from Jupiter to have any kind of gravitational or electrical interaction. But when it comes up and crosses the ecliptic on its outbound path, it will have, on the 24th of April, 2025, a very, very tight electrical alignment with the planet, well, with the twin star Jupiter. Let's call it what it is. The twin star of our sun, Jupiter, will have a very good electrical alignment. And this comet K2 will be out literally crossing the orbit of Saturn. That's how far away it'll be from Jupiter. But when Saturn and Jupiter align, we get a pretty good jolt. It's a pretty good cross-system electrical connection. But this comet, it's hard to say if Saturn, which is a major-sized electrical discharge, has a bigger oomph or contribution to this electrical discharge than will this comet. And I'm thinking that Saturn probably holds a better punch. But that'll be interesting to see, because Jupiter, we could see cometary-type effects around Jupiter or the moons, or things like the Great Red Spot, which is driven literally by electrical currents from outside of Jupiter. Like if you saw it in the plasma sense, you would see a leech-like structure, plasma structure. Of course, the leech is a little animal that attaches onto fish. But that's what these look like, and Earth has many of these that are attached to it all the time. Large comets have many tails that are attached like this. But the Great Red Spot of Jupiter is a cyclonic storm, and it's driven, it's relatively deep in the atmosphere, but it's driven by electrical currents that are in the ionosphere of Jupiter, and then which connect out into outer space. And it's that part that's electrical plasma that's sticking out into outer space that if you could take a picture of it and represent it as something not quite so nebulous, it would look like a leech flailing around out there as Jupiter spins on its axis as it goes around the sun. Okay, so anyway, comet K2, very interesting, and I'm sure I'll be people will be reminding me as that time goes. Maybe I'll put that on my calendar after the show here. Next topic. Now, this came up because recently I've been looking at these. They're kind of like YouTube shorts, and they only last for maybe 30 seconds. But when I get kind of like too much work and I'm at my desk and I'm kind of like burned out and you know, because I really have a lot of work that I'm going through right now, the wing generator, the water filter business, and there's a lot of stuff that I have to do. So I pick up the phone and I pop up some of these videos, and I'll watch for 5 minutes and I'll go through these. And it might be Joe Rogan, or it might be, you know, it might be, who knows, different personalities talking. And it's just a way of kind of letting my brain, you know, wander off into Never Never Land, just as a way of relaxing for a minute. But anyway, I've noticed that Neil deGrasse Tyson has been on the Joe Rogan show. And of course, Joe is a fighter. He's a guy that, you know, is a, what do you call it, a master of ceremonies at these boxing events and stuff. But he's a smart guy, too. I mean, he's a talker. He likes to talk about stuff. And he has these mainstream guests on there, one of which is Neil deGrasse Tyson, which, if you know anything about me and my work, I really don't like the guy. He's a tier two textbook repeater who marches the party line, you know, wears his PhD badge on his forehead, and everything he says, like Carl Sagan, his master teacher, because Neil deGrasse Tyson redid the Cosmos series, you know, so he's pretty famous, and he's been on TV, and he's the curator of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, so he's been on, you know, like, I'm sure, Netflix and History Channel specials and all of that stuff, you know, major. So he's, you know, famous and marches the party line of NASA and NASA axioms of astronomy. So anyway, he'll be on some of these short ones with Joe Rogan. And so sometimes I'll save these. I'll punch a thing and it like shares it and saves it or whatever. So I have a record of what they were saying. But it turns out that he made a comment recently about terraforming Mars. And Elon Musk has made some comments recently about terraforming Mars. And the idea is that they think that all the water, there's huge amount of water evidence on Mars. And of course, I was the one that initiated all of that, the center 8 pages of my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, the middle 8 pages of that are the entire surface of Mars in high-resolution photographs, pointing out all of the water resources that Mars had. And, of course, NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, some of the scientists there stole my work, had somebody paint in the oceans, you know, computer graphics, showing where the oceans were, and then they said, oh, well, the oceans just sank into the ground, and now it's there in the form of permafrost. And, of course, they don't talk about how that really wouldn't be possible because Mars doesn't have an atmosphere. Well, what happened to Mars's atmosphere that was there to hold the oceans in place? It had to have a very Earth-like atmosphere. And then they go, oh, it was billions of years ago. And, of course, there's no rhyme or reason for saying that. So anyway, the best thing they can say is that the water is contained in the planet Mars, in the surface, in the form of permafrost, and all you got to do is do something to get that out of there. And then all of a sudden you'd have oceans again on Mars. So Elon Musk's idea is that you drop nuclear bombs. Excuse me, Elon. But I like a lot of stuff that Elon does, and I don't like a lot of stuff that he does, like the 10,000 satellite thing. Rich people with too much money shouldn't be doing stuff. There should be some way of reining these people in. I never was a big fan of Tesla automobiles, although I think it was amazing technology in building gigafactories for batteries, which they need for the Tesla cars. And now, interestingly enough, Elon is going to hydrogen cars, something that I said all along, is that hydrogen is the big winner in the transportation agenda. But anyway, back to Mars. So Elon is saying, oh, you just drop some nuclear bombs on Mars, that'll melt the permafrost, it'll go up in the atmosphere, and everybody be happy. I don't think so. I think it's a terrible idea, and there's no proof. I mean, the water isn't there, so where did it go? The only place they can imagine is into the ground. Where the water went
was it was pulled off when Venus the comet came by in historical times, and all of the ancients tell us about this, and it was one of the things, one of the very great discoveries of Velikovsky, is that Mars was a water planet, and that's long before, long before, we're talking 1950s, before anybody ever sent a spacecraft to Mars and discovered the surface features, etc., of Mars, and that the atmosphere and oceans were pulled off of Mars. It was a blue planet, that it in fact had inhabitants, human inhabitants, and there's a whole other side to that story with a Baal worship, and that goes into the, anyway, that's a whole other ballgame. I've talked about that in my show before. But at any rate, that's the Elon Musk solution, is to blow up the, drop nuclear bombs, the water will come up out of the ground, and everybody will be happy. And of course, they don't talk about the fact that you need an atmosphere to hold that water in place, otherwise it'll just evaporate away, like right now, because you need atmospheric pressure. If the Earth did not have an atmosphere, the oceans would evaporate into outer space like right now, because there's no pressure, there's no atmospheric pressure holding it in place. That's literally the way the oceans and lakes, etc., are held onto the surface of the Earth. It's not just gravity. Gravity would not be enough, because that the even in an ice form, it would melt away, it would sublimate, because there's no pressure, atmospheric pressure, to hold it in place. Okay, so the Neil deGrasse Tyson solution, for, and by the way, I'm going to give you the real solution after we get done with this. The Neil deGrasse Tyson solution is, so it says, oh, you just budge a little comet that's got full of water and you collide it with Mars. And he said, you, by the way, you could do that with Earth too if we ever needed more water. And I'm like, oh my goodness, these people are nuts. And then he goes, well, it would cause a little bit of climate change. Oh my goodness, absolutely insane to nudge a comet so it purposefully hits Earth. And then you have other people talking about comets hitting Earth and destroying the entire world population. But you got Neil deGrasse Tyson saying you nudge a little comet and it hits Earth and gives us more water. Why, you know, just insanity. But this is the, this is typical of tier two science. Just doesn't make any sense at all. Not logical. Okay, and so this was the Neil deGrasse Tyson solution. Divert a comet and to hit Mars, and then it would bring the oceans back to Mars from the comet. The only problem is, comets, little comets, the size that you would nudge to push their orbit and then hit the planet, the problem is they don't have any water. We've been to a dozen comets with the, you know, collectively around planet Earth. The different space agencies have been to a dozen comets, and not a single one of them has a drop of water on it. So, you know, these people are still in fairy tale la-la land with this dirty snowball comet thing. And, you mean, deGrasse Tyson must be familiar with all of these space probes that have gone nose-to-nose with the nucleus of a comet, starting with Halley's Comet in about 1986, when the Giotto spacecraft went right nose-to-nose with the nucleus of Comet Halley's nucleus, and no water, no ice. It's a hot, dry, black rock. And the other ones they saw had like a tar-like substance baked onto them, nothing coming off the nucleus, no steam engine effect. And then there was the Comet 67P, European Space Agency, landing the Philae lander onto the literally landed on the nucleus of the comet, and there ain't no ice or snow or water of any, in any form, and nothing coming off the nucleus to form this water tail that clearly you see from a distance. So I mean, very clearly my plasma discharge comet model is the correct model, but so trying to collide, make a comet collide with the planet Mars to give it water. It's a stupid idea in the first place, and you would never get any water. And even if the comet had water on it, the explosion would be so immense that it would vaporize all that water and it would just go off into outer space, because Mars doesn't have an atmosphere. And even if it did have an atmosphere, most of that water would end up in outer space if a comet had water. So, I mean, these people are just rock stupid. I mean, just, you know, anyway. But how would you terraform Mars? Okay, well, Mars is in the terrestrial planet region where you have a lot of water and hydrogen and oxygen, basically. And so the question is, how could you cause Mars to become like a comet so that it would draw in material, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, sulfur, and other compounds that are out in that region of outer space, out beyond Mars? And the way you would do that is you would draw a tether out. Now, we know from the space shuttle tether experiment that went awry, which I told the, hopefully you have heard that story, where I invented a magnetic propulsion system and it was stolen by these clowns out in La Jolla, California, and they were working on tethers to let out of the shuttle. And I ended up in their office out in La Jolla talking to them, and I said, what you're doing here is really a bad idea. You're going to destroy the space shuttle. And the idea is they were going to let this tether out into outer space and drag it through the local magnetic field and generate a current and power like things in the space shuttle as a form of generating electricity. And I said, don't do it, because as soon as you let that tether out, it's going to discharge the local capacitor and you're going to have a big explosion. And, oh, no, they didn't listen to me. And it took them quite a few shuttle trips. They finally got this thing placed on the shuttle. They opened up the bay doors of the shuttle and let this thing out. And it was supposed to go out a number of kilometers. That was the expectation. This thing didn't get out there more than a couple hundred yards, and bam, it discharged the local capacitor and it blew one of the doors off the space shuttle. Literally blew the door off. And these clowns, it destroyed all the electronics in the shuttle itself. They were able to patch this thing up and come in on a backup computer, because the shuttle needs computerized activity. They were able to come back in and land this thing and not, you know, kill the crew. But they learned a lesson, and I told them not to do that in their office in La Jolla. And so anyway, this is a technique that can be used for terraforming a planet, where you let out a tether with a weight on it and get Mars to start discharging that capacitor out there like a comet, and it would start drawing in all of this material. And I'll just let you know something. Mars lost its atmosphere and oceans. What we think, and I don't date things, this is Velikovsky's dating. He's talking about before the 1500 BC dating, where the 1500 BC dating, when the comet Venus came by Earth. So it would have been maybe 100, 200 years prior to that. Who knows when it came by Mars and lifted the oceans and atmosphere off the planet Mars. So at any rate, since that time, Mars has been accumulating atmosphere. And the reason we know this is because NASA sent a probe out to measure the density of the Martian atmosphere. And about 10 years later, the reason they sent the probe out was they wanted to do aerobraking as a form of slowing a satellite down as it went in to the Martian atmosphere. So that's when they were planning these Martian rovers to land on Mars. And they were like a big balloon, so they'd come in and aerobrake, and then they'd hit the ground and roll, and then they'd break open this egg shape type of thing, and then the little rover would wheel out and drive around Mars. So that was the plan. Okay, so they send the probe out, and 10 years they measure the density, the atmospheric expansion, the extension of the atmosphere of Mars. And they come back 10 years later with the probe, and the atmosphere of Mars had doubled in extent and in density in those 10 years. So Mars is rebuilding its atmosphere from the point where it lost it. And we know that Earth lost its atmosphere on occasions throughout history where there were mass extinctions. And that's due to a large comet coming by. Okay, so at any rate, the way to terraform Mars is not by dropping nuclear bombs on it, not by crashing a comet into it that has no water anyway, but by terraforming, by inducing the discharge of the solar capacitor so that Mars becomes a comet, literally discharges the solar capacitor, starts rapidly building up atmosphere, including water, and make it into a water planet again. And how long would that take? Maybe 1,000 years, maybe longer. I don't know. We don't have enough experience with that. But if you could make Mars into a large comet, then, you know, it would be a matter of time until it absorbed or accumulated enough water and atmosphere to create a living planet again. Living meaning having water and atmosphere at the surface. Okay. So anyway, I think that's the mode that I'm going to have in the future. I'm going to be talking about topics that are brought up in the news media, etc., and then also giving my solution to it. And the idea that Earth somehow needs more water, Earth really does not need more water. We got plenty of water on planet Earth. We simply don't know how to manage it. And there are issues with the water on Earth in that there's, you know, fresh water is a commodity in certain places. So when you see places that have a high level of overpopulation, a high density concentration, overpopulation locally, they typically also have a water problem. And so that's one thing I'm happen to be working on and have worked on. In fact, I was in an XPRIZE myself dealing with that very issue, how to extract water from the atmosphere using wind power. And I think most people who are my listeners know about that particular little venture. It took a year and a half of my life, and ended up being a finalist in the Water Abundance XPRIZE. And using the wing generator, a 50-kilowatt version of the wing generator, powering two atmospheric water generators that were extracting water from the air, and then also was awarded the Technology Innovation Achievement Award for that innovative technology. But so anyway, water on Earth. And I'm also have a product line of reverse osmosis also run by the wing generator. And there's a demand for that. There's a demand for that in a worldwide setting, because reverse osmosis has some drawbacks in that for every gallon of water that you get on average of fresh water out of the seawater, for every gallon that you get, there's another gallon that's wasted, and you have to do something with it, and it has all of this brine in the high concentration in the water. But there's a problem. There's cities like Los Angeles, certain areas where they've outlawed reverse osmosis. You can't have it in your house anymore because they're flushing that brine down into the sewer system is giving them a lot of problems. So they're saying, okay, you cannot do reverse osmosis anymore here. And if you have a big plant like San Diego, or if you go down to, say, Tampa Bay, they use a lot of reverse osmosis down there. then you can send that brine back out into the ocean. And as long as the fresh water that was used in the city goes back out into the ocean to remix with that brine, then you're okay. But if not, then you have an issue where you're killing off the ocean because you have this really heavy salt brine going back into the ocean off of the reverse osmosis plant. And so anyway, there's ways of dealing with that. And so those are some of the private areas of research that I've been involved in, kind of in the background. Okay, switching gears. And by the way, I know there's some issues with my sound here. And I've been going through, I don't know what's going on. I think I'm getting some outside influence, let's just put it that way, affecting my ability to transmit this radio show. But we'll be dealing with that. That's an issue that I'm dealing with in the background. Because some of my headsets all of a sudden one day just stopped working. I was in the middle of John Moore's show one day, and one of my good headsets that I've been using for years just stopped working. So I think I'm getting a little help from our friends, if you know what I mean. Okay, I want to talk about where my webpage is going. We're going to have a new webpage here posted fairly soon, maybe within a couple of weeks. And also all of my books. I'm getting to the point where we're going to be putting up a very big library. I right now have about 14 books, and it's soon to be about 25 books. And so this is going to be a very nice little encyclopedia of my work, and then also collaborating with putting my last year's show into a package, the paid cast, which I had for 4 years, being put into the education package. So I'm archiving and accumulating all of this information that I've produced into a very good format. And I have hired some professionals to help me do this, not just my own work, but hired professionals to package this so that it's more convenient for the public to use. Okay, so once again, remember my new book, The Real History of Man and Earth, Myth, Magic, and Mayhem, available on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And remember, the Christmas sales for the water filter stuff is still up there. My other webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. And the prices of the water filters will be coming down shortly also, so that'll be posted on the webpage. And but you can still get the Christmas discounts if you go there today, because I have not changed those yet. At any rate, good to be back with my regular routine on this show. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.